Hi, and welcome to the FIF Pro podcast, Changing the Game. I'm Allie Riley. In this series, we'll be speaking to international female footballers about their personal journeys to success and find out what it's taken for them to reach the top of their game. And in celebration of the 30th anniversary of the FIFA Women's World Cup, we'll also be looking at how women's football has evolved over the last three decades and discuss what more needs to be done to protect the well-being of players and ensure that future generations can reach their full potential. Today, I'm talking with Caroline Jonsson.
I think we have a window of opportunity of a couple of years now where football has to transfer into a much more transparent organization. And with that comes sustainability, quality, diversity, and good condition.
Caroline is one of Sweden's greatest goalkeepers, playing at three Olympic Games, one World Cup, and two UEFA Women's Championships, including being part of the team that came second in the 2003 FIFA Women's World Cup. Caroline was named Sweden's Goalkeeper of the Year in 2003 and 2006. And since retiring from international football, has taken on roles as a FIF Pro global board member and a sports psychologist. In this episode, we'll be looking back at the Women's World Cup of 2003. Caroline Jonsson, so happy to have you on the FIF Pro podcast. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Ali.
Let's start with this World Cup. Obviously, a very, very successful tournament for you and Team Sweden in 2003. What do you remember about the qualifiers, about the tournament moving from China to the US? What was that like for you?
Well, for us as a team, I think we were kind of excited to go to US instead. The 99 was there and some of the teammates were actually playing in that championship. So I think most of them actually were happy with that. I wouldn't say it wasn't like last minute, so we kind of knew we were going to the US instead. I think that was good for us as a team. But I think the whole context of the disease is what we see now. And I think looking back, I think it was a good decision to move it. But there and then, you couldn't understand why this disease and so on and so on. But I think we were kind of pleased with playing in the US since we know how much of a sport nation that is. So most of us were excited.
And for anyone listening who doesn't remember, doesn't know, we're speaking about the SARS catastrophe that was going on. And so China was set to host and it was moved from a health perspective. I think there was certainly a lot of conversations around when will it end? When will the disease end? When will it be safe? And then after the US had hosted the 99 World Cup, they were the choice to host it again. Although I read that Sweden had put kind of a bid to host it.
That's true.
Reading about the tournament and, you know, something that stood out to me, seeing the final standings and who had played in the semifinals and the final. I'm fascinated that now, and it hasn't been necessarily linear for all four of these countries, but Germany, Sweden, USA, Canada.
Yeah.
We look at the rankings today, still all in the top six.
Yeah.
With Canada in sixth place, but obviously we know that they just won the Olympics. So what do you attribute Sweden's success too? Is it just the investment? Like, was Sweden just so far ahead of the times in terms of women's football?
Well, I think it's a mixture. I think in the Canada US situation, I think it's a Title IX, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, put the foundation in making it available for women to play football and to have a career path where you actually could have your best years when it comes to college, and then you have a broad mass to choose from for your national team. So the Title IX, I think, was crucial for the US and Canada. When it comes to Germany and Sweden, I think it's also how the countries are built up. I think they are and have been in front when it comes to quality. And early on, we had a system where you could play football as a female or woman. When I say early on, I think it's terrible still, it's the 70s. But and I also think, especially in Sweden, we have what we call the 51% rule, which means more or less that all our clubs are owned by the club. We don't have anybody benefiting from having a club system. It's also not linked to school or other performances. So basically, football in Sweden has been available for a lot of people. And we have this vulnerability that many others have, that you have a owner and you have to pay to be in the club and you have to pay to get trained. In Sweden, we have volunteers instead of vulnerability when it comes to that. So there is some flaws with that, but basically when it works, it's great. So you have volunteers doing the club and the trainings, which keeps the cost down, and many people can actually just start to play and go back out of it and come back. And we have a broad system where you can go through like national teams and schools and things like that. But you can also go through the system just by playing in the divisions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two separate roads to make it to the top. And I think that's also why we've been successful early on in women's game.
Right. Well, I think you bring up a couple different points that in other countries, cultures, have been obstacles for women in sport. We have society, how women are viewed, sexism, we have a lack of investment. And then I think it's interesting about the clubs and not necessarily being attached to schools. I mean, it's quite different from the US, but has also been effective.
Yeah.
And I think too, having multiple paths to get to the top is so beneficial. And again, it's funny because we say this is a long time ago, but not really a long time ago.
No.
And I think what is a little bit hard to see now is that with the club system that has been so beneficial to women in Sweden playing soccer, I think the clubs are starting to get surpassed by clubs in other countries. What, as a Swede myself, what do we need to do to be able to keep up, you know? And again, with clubs not necessarily being linked to men's teams, as you're seeing now in Italy, in the US, in England, we see it in Germany as well. How are these clubs going to keep up with the rest of the world?
Well, I think you have to compete smart, let's say it like that. I think we will have really big problems competing financially. So if you look at only salaries, I think it will be really, really hard to compete. Then we have a structure around the team. So you have, of course, facilities to train and locker rooms and things like that. I think it's also going to be a little bit difficult. But here it comes to what's good enough, like what you need to perform. You don't need a really brand new locker room, which is spotless, but you need some other indication of actually enhance your performance. And I think it doesn't necessarily cost that much. So I think we have to be smart with our resources. We have to be instead, I think, a place where you can go if you're kind of not in the best leagues, but you will play in a good league with very, very well-organized structures around you as a player. So you know you're going to go there, you will get really good games, but you will also get security. You know you're going to be paid, you know you're going to have your health care. You can be a parent, you can be sick, and you can do a dual career. You can do all these things, which actually benefits you as a human being and benefits you as a player. And I think if we can do that and compete smart with that, I don't see a problem of us competing in the worldwide bigger competitions, because we will have teams that will have Swedish players in the biggest leagues, in the best teams. So I'm not afraid of us lacking talent out in the world, seeing and taking benefits of what's going on in women's football. And I think we can use that in the national team. However, we need to be able to get them back in the end of their careers, maybe keep the talented players a couple of years longer, but also get the players outside of Sweden, which are great players, but maybe not the next star in Lyon, for example. So I do think we have a pretty good chance to compete at national team level. And club level, we have to be able to also look at the different transfer windows, which we have to deal with in the countries that have a different season. So meaning that you have to have a wider and bigger squad, maybe, to be able to handle the end of season, new season, and still be able to compete in Champions League, for example. So there is some different things that for our club teams are harder than other teams when it comes to, for example, Champions League and so on. But that's manageable. but something you have to consider at least.
Right. See, I love this because obviously speaking to players, especially current players, we talk so much about what we as players want in terms of salaries. We're going through this CBA negotiation still. I think I've mentioned it on a few episodes now in the NWSL. And salaries is such a big focus. And you're getting these clubs now that can pay these large salaries. Obviously, in women's sport in general, in women's soccer, we want to be able to have it all. That's the goal. We want high salaries. We want the security. You want to be able to be protected if you decide to start a family. You want to be able to have healthcare, retirement. The honest truth is that I don't know if there's one club that can necessarily provide every single thing at this moment. There are some clubs that certainly come close, and I mean to the whole roster. So it's interesting to talk about from now the club perspective, this perspective that you're giving. It's like first for the players, because we can't have it all, unfortunately, right now. But we're talking about holistically. What do you want when you go to a team? And I think this is interesting because the world is getting bigger for women's soccer players, and there are more and more teams to go to. And if you look at the leagues or the teams, that yes, you might not be earning as much in your monthly paycheck, but the things that have value are everything that you mentioned. And that is something that other leagues and clubs, and I definitely in my experience, Swedish clubs can provide. And that leads me to address mental health and mental well-being, which I know that you have a lot of experience in. And I'm realizing more and more in my career, especially after talking to Yuki, how important and valuable that piece is. And again, of course, we want to have it all so players aren't having to worry about that or prioritizing one thing over the other. But I'm realizing with trying to give advice to some of my New Zealand teammates, players who are looking for their first professional contract, what are you going to prioritize? So are you seeing now more, I hope, in clubs and in national teams, more of an understanding of the importance of mental health?
I would say yes. I think that's a general, not even assumption. I would say that at least it's talked about, it's on the agenda. I think historically it's been talked about a lot as performance enhancement.
Right, definitely.
I like to talk about proactive mental health. So not necessarily always when you have problems. I think we can do so much to prevent a lot of players having mental health issues. And I think maybe that's our biggest contribution that we could do. And I think both leagues, clubs, national teams, but especially maybe the responsibility should be on the players' unions. When it comes to you actually having issues, then the independence that a player union would provide, where you don't have to go to your employer and talk about the things that you're most afraid of or think is going to hurt your abilities mm-hmm. to get a new contract or to play.
Oh, yeah.
I think that is the problem that many players, either you do it subconsciously or consciously, you don't want to talk to your employer. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that is crucial and something that you in normal healthcare consider always, like the independence of your treater. So I think that's a very, very important role for the players' union around the world to have. But when it comes to proactively work with mental health, we can all do much more. And I think just by normalization, like how do we as human beings act? What is the basic of our emotional system? When I go out and speak, and I had a lecture yesterday for the university about our emotional systems as human beings and how that affects either you perform in a game or you go to your club and want to negotiate a contract, or you're at home and you're going to tell your partner that, no, I don't like your idea. Whatever it is, if you're not aware of how strong and powerful our emotional system is and how that works, it will always be harder for you to act in the direction you would like. And it's also really hard to figure out when you don't, because you're not even aware. So I think we can do so much education in how we work as human beings, and especially our emotional system, which is created for us to survive and evolve. But anxiety, for example, I mean, it has had a role in history, but a lot of players are actually suffering from anxiety, which is directly linked to their performance. And just by saying this is normal, this is how we work, this is how everybody works as human beings, many times I see their shoulders go, oh, just by that. Then when you learn and you start to realize, you can deal with it differently. You understand that emotions are triggering thoughts, and thoughts are just thoughts. It's not behavior. It doesn't hurt you. But so many people and players are ashamed of their thoughts. And maybe shame and guilt is one of the hardest emotions to deal with. So I work once a week with only elite athletes in Sweden and as a psychologist. So it's actually under the banner of a hospital, which is rare. It's only in Sweden and one or few more countries in the world where you as an elite athlete get access to the healthcare system when it comes to mental health and issues. But I always start with education. And I tend to see such big relief only by educating them how we work as human beings. So that's usually where I start. And I think that's something we can do much more around the world in clubs and leagues and federations. Long answer.
Yeah, well, I learned so much just from that. And I think anyone working with you is obviously very, very lucky. And I can see how it applies, of course, in sport. But when you mentioned those examples, pretty much in every aspect of our lives.
Yeah.
Did your interest in psychology come from being a player, being a goalie? How much were you already aware, educated in this when you were playing?
Well, I think it actually comes from an interest of human beings. Like, I really care about human beings and my friends and myself. But I think the interest came more or less from there first. And yeah, I like to talk to people and just very curious of how they react and think. And then when I was a goalkeeper, it was kind of hard to get into the psychology program, to be honest. It's high grades and you play football. And so it took me quite a long time to get in to the university. And while I did that, I studied a lot of other things similar to psychology. And the applied psychology was easy to me because I was a goalkeeper and you are an individual in a group. So you have kind of this perspective. I just give you an example. You, especially 10 years ago, you were the only person in the team with the view from the goal. The coaches were from the side. The cameras was from the side. And if I wouldn't speak up about the perspective of the view from the goalkeeper position, maybe my central defenders could agree with me one time or another, but they were kind of more caught up in the game. I could be more of an observer, I would say. And then you had arguments with the coach, and then they had the camera view from the side. So actually, I told my goalkeeper coach to put up a camera behind my goal, and then we had some more interesting discussions. But I think as a goalie, you're first of all, you can't come to training and say, what are we going to do today? Because most of the goalies, again, back at the days when I played, were coming to the training and had to figure out what they should do themselves for 30 minutes or so. So you had to be responsible for that. And then you had the position of observing a lot of time, especially in games. And I think in that, you also observe other persons and teammates and players and systems. And then when I started to study, I still played. So then I could actually try my theories in the team. And the end of my career, we also had a psychology coach. So our coach in Umeå in the last year was also a psychologist. So we kind of had the ability to try a lot of things. So I think it helped a lot to have had my education similar to when I played, to be honest. I've been lucky. I mean, I've had, I think, a normal life. But when you see all these problems that other human beings are fighting, you can't hide when you're in the team. You know, you see behaviors and you see when you travel or when you live with people, you kind of lose a lot of the protection you have outside the society, which I think is also great because the normal way of behavior is not so normal anymore because it widens. You see your teammate with their own small personal different things they do. And then all of a sudden that becomes normal. You can do that or that or that or that. And I think for me, that helped a lot because if they can do that and I do that and everything is normal and everybody is okay, it gives you security as a human being. But if you don't see it like that, it can also be very frightening to be in a team and have people coming in your safe zone, so to speak. You can't hide when you're away. So for many, that's also a problem if you're not dealing with it. But for me, it was more of a relief to see that other people are also what we would call strange. And I don't think it's strange. I just think we handle things differently.
Yeah, we're all different.
Exactly.
Right. But suffer from or experience many similar emotions that maybe we don't talk about. So you think you're alone.
Exactly.
So how do you think the Swedish national team has benefited from using a sports psychologist? And is that something that you have helped kind of, I mean, that's amazing that you were able to have a coach like that when you were still playing. But is that, do you think that's still being maintained? Are the clubs starting to kind of catch on to that?
I think the clubs are catching on. The two guys which are working now for the federation in the men's and women's team, I know pretty well. And their whole concept of how they're working, they call it football psychology. And there is a term called next action, which kind of been spread a little bit in Sweden, I think. And since I know them and I know how they are working, I love it a lot. Because, again, I think sports psychology especially has been very much performance-based, of course, if you look at it from a historical perspective. It's also been very much about putting yourself in a zone, either positive thinking or just in a specific emotion where you can perform better. And the whole take on that is, of course, it's easier to perform better if you feel better. The only catch with that is that sometimes when you feel very happy and, you know, everything's great, you can actually miss things because you're not focused and you're already happy that you saved or did the penalty well or did the passing well because you've always seen it in your mind and then it worked and then you're not focused. Other from that, it's kind of nice to be in this positive mood, let's say it like that. But performance doesn't work like that. You perform here and now, never in the past time and never in the future. And when you understand that you're performing, you understand it logically when I say it, most people do, mm-hmm. but to understand it in the concept of when you're actually playing, that you can only affect next action, which means you can actually affect what you do right now. And when you get help to kind of be aware of that and come back to that constantly in the game, okay, what can I do now? I think that helps the game, the teammates, the player. And I think that's what our Swedish, both Daniel and Rasmus, have done a lot lately. And I think that's also why our men's and women's national team perform really well. But you have to have the support of the team and the coach staffs, because if you don't see eye to eye on this, it can be even harder for the players. Mm-hmm. So if there's going to be whatever coach talking about psychology in a team, that person need to have had the acceptance and buy-in from the coaches, because otherwise the players will be hostage.
Yeah, I think that's something we talk about a lot with the New Zealand national team, and I'm sure clubs and teams that don't have a lot of funding, maybe trying to prioritize. Again, we talk about this with players choosing clubs and what you want to prioritize in terms of your life and your career when you choose a club. It's unfortunately, I think, the same with teams now. You know, first it was fitness. You saw that an emphasis on fitness. And once one team is successful, like USA, in that, you kind of see the trend. I think nutrition has definitely been on an upswing. And I think now more recently, sleep with this holistic and psychology and mental health.
Wow.
And it's such a shame, I think, that when clubs, federations have to choose, am I going to take now two physios or a massage therapist to the World Cup or a psychologist? And as players, I think it's hard to say one is more important than the other. And that's where your understanding and FIFA Pro and players voicing these concerns, voicing being open and trying to move away from having this stigma around having mental health issues is so important, because FIFA, the different leagues, the clubs, maybe when we're asking to have funding, you know, these are big things that we don't want to have to choose if we're going to feel well in our bodies or feel well in our minds. It shouldn't be a choice that the players have to make.
Couldn't agree with you more.
But going back to when you were a player, of course, and I want to get into a little bit to the Sweden Germany rivalry, but do you have a favorite game from the tournament? Do you have a favorite memory? When you think of 2003 and that World Cup, what comes to mind first?
Well, I had a lecture yesterday about the applied sports psychology. And to be honest, that tournament for me personally, when it comes to issues, dealing with issues, was the worst I've ever had. 4 days before the game, my shoulder jumped out. I don't know the English term for it, but
dislocated.
Yeah, exactly. Hospital and MRIs and all of those things. And then before the second game on the night, I had an allergic reaction, which I was all swollen and red, and I don't know, it was blasters all over my body and something I've never had. And I slept through the day. We played on the game on the night.
So at this point, you've played in both of these games after having the dislocated shoulder and having this reaction.
Yeah, yeah. And then on the third game, we played Nigeria and won 3-0. And in the locker room, I had such a severe pain in my stomach. And I don't know if, you know, you took away the tape on your shoulder with some form of gasoline, something. So I thought maybe I'm a bit dizzy because of that, because it goes right up your nose. But I had such a pain. So I kind of almost fainted in the locker room and I didn't know what it was. And the doctor came and eventually I got a morphine shot and then didn't help and got another one, kind of relaxed, went into the hospital again and it was something, a cyst in the stomach. So again, hospital. And then I was actually not training the day after and then came back. And when we were playing Brazil in the quarterfinal on the game day, when I was warming up, our coach came and said I couldn't play because the doctor of the game didn't approve my shots. So that game we played with Sofia in goal, which hadn't played, the team had to restart, which Sofia, I mean, she hasn't been credited enough. Go in, playing the game, and the team as well. And you're sitting there devastated. It's one of the most important games in your life, and you're taken away from the field. And Sofia actually trips Marta in the penalty area, and the referee calls for a penalty, and is running to Sofia and takes up the card. And it's yellow. And everybody, because if she would have had a red card, we would have had an outfielder in the goal. So I think, and everywhere in Sweden was the note in the newspaper saying I couldn't play because I had menstrual pain. So that was also an issue, which I still think isn't solved, which I still work a lot with. And that's the issue of the menstrual cycle, having mens, PMS, endometriosis, all these things, which isn't discussed enough in women's sports and in sports. And then we had the semifinal, and I think I actually did my biggest mistake ever in that game against Canada in the end of a game. And this is when I talk about, I always train kids. And one of the first things I tell them, if they're 7, 8, or 10, is like, you never save the ball until you saved it. Like, again, here and now, it's very profound. But that game, it was, I had a good emotion. It was kind of wet. game on the night, and it was the perfect shot for me to just save. And it slips through my fingers, post in 1-0. And I can tell you that at that time, we turned it around 1-2, 2-1. But I think that would have been hard for me to handle long time after. Not because people would say I was a bad goalkeeper. I had no problem with that. Fair enough. But that was also a qualification for Olympic Games. And the Olympic Games for us in Sweden, especially then, and also for a lot of other teams, meant resources to be able to train in the mornings, paid to the trainers, but actually could pay and train the next generation. So it's actually very much in line with the ability women in Sweden had to train
from. Oh my gosh. So that's a defining moment for women in soccer in Sweden. Talk about pressure.
For me, it was that pressure was the worst for me to bury as a goalkeeper.
Oh my gosh.
I thought that was what kept me awake in the night. It wasn't if I would perform well or not for me personally. It was if I would make a mistake, it would take this away from the kids. And that's how I saw it. And to be honest, still today, I'm so grateful that we won that game, that I didn't have to carry for the rest of my career that I made this one mistake and we wouldn't qualify for the Olympics. For me, that was the worst thing I could imagine, to be honest. So that's a memory where I feel so grateful. But then, of course, we lost the final again on a golden goal. And we lost the European final 2 years before on a golden goal. And when you are a goalkeeper and you lose on golden goals, well, you're always the last one who could have done something. So that's something I also have to, you know, accept. But it still hurts.
Well, your great fear has certainly not come to pass. And I think the national team and the players' voices as well, fighting for what the team deserves, what women in sport deserves, I think is just increasing with someone like Caroline Sager at the helm of that, which is very encouraging. And I think too, having you involved with FIF Pro, I think that was hearing you speak when you came to us at whether it was Eldebay or Rosengård at the time, I think really opened my eyes to what a player's voice could really do. And you're a huge, huge inspiration for me and really motivate me to want to be involved in somehow in the game when I'm done. How important do you think, you know, I talked to Lucy Bronze about how important it is to have current players at the table, a seat at the table. But how important do you think it is to have former players involved at the top and to be in positions of power?
I think it's crucial, to be honest. I do think it's equally crucial to have the actual players at the table. But the problem with actual now active players is that they don't always have the time.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, they shouldn't always look at the bigger picture either. They should be the ones on the ground feeling what's right or not, what's working, what's not working. What I think the former player should do is use their experience of what they actually experienced to change something for the next generation. I think that's like the former player's role in especially the unions. For me, now talking about FIFPro's role, I had so many things. And I call it gratitude guilt. I mean, you know, you said Eldebay or Rosengård. I actually played in Malmö FF when it was one club. And honestly, we've been thrown out from the club.
Yes.
And gratitude guilt is something internally. You internalize how worthy are you, in this case, as a women football player. When you constantly get to hear that you're not interesting to look at, you should be happy to be able to play, even if it's 10 o'clock in the night, you should be glad you get a field even, or you should be glad you get all balls to play with.
Yes.
And so on. And so if you grow up with that and you hear constantly that you're cost, you're something that nobody's interested in to watch.
You're a charity case of a club, you know, they have to have a women's team. They're forced to have a women's team, or, you know, they just, it looks good. Like, you hear everything all the time.
Exactly. And you get that internalized. It becomes almost your own voice that you feel that you're not worthy enough when you look at yourself, which means you can't push.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the external threat, to be honest. Like, you have your internal ways. That's a psychological term, but you kind of been internalized in, I'm not worthy of a big field, or I'm not worthy of this salary, or I'm not worthy of. But then you have the external threat. In this case, it was actually for us, we got thrown out of Malmö FF because they thought it would cost too much. That's 2000 something, so it's almost 20 years ago now. And with Rosengård, obviously, it's very clear that women's football makes their own resumption and can actually live on their own. That's pretty much very clear. And Malmö now, again, with a new team leaders and boards and so on, have a women's team. So I'm talking about a couple of years back. But when you experience that, which I did, you get what I call a gratitude guilt. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to push anymore. But when we did the 3 World Cup and we had more spectators than the men ever had on TV, we came back and we had people all over Stockholm cheering on us coming back. And it meant something for people. And eventually I felt my gratitude guilt lift off my shoulders and say, hey, people actually do care of what we're doing.
Yeah, you had proof.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, I think, very unusual that you get that type of proof. But we got it. And that was what made me understand that this had nothing to do with our team or our team's performance or my performance. Because as an elite athlete, you want to have control. You want to be able to control your destiny. And I think that's also the drive we have. Like, do it better, do it better. You can do better. And you keep pushing yourself and your team. And eventually, I thought, the resources will come. If we only win the European gold medal, if we only win Olympics, if we only win a World Cup. But I mean, we lost 2 golden finals. I was picked for the world team. We had another couple of players were picked for that too. And we had this spectator rate on the TV. And nothing happened. And then you feel like, shit,
right?
It doesn't matter what I do or what we do as a team. It's something else. And that's when I hit the glass ceiling. And when I hit that, okay, as an athlete, and elite athlete, okay, what can I do now? Then I thought, okay, now I have to work with structures. And that's how I got engaged in the Players Union in Sweden. And we started a foundation called Fair Pay Foundation, which actually helped sponsors and regions, towns to sponsor sports equal. And I also eventually found out about FIFPro, which was an organization only for professional male football players. So I was at one meeting in Madrid early in the, I don't know, 12, 13 something maybe. And basically, okay, this is how we have to do it. And they hired me and you had to go to the board and see if they would go with a plan to make women a member. And I had to present a plan for that. And we had 0 women members in the world. But we had some unions like Sweden and a couple of others that had female members in the country. So building on that, I went around with the brochure, joined FIFPro. And to be honest, I think women's football are amazing like that. We are having relationships over the countries. We are actually hanging out and we are sharing knowledge and we want to make women's football and football better. And I think that's what we built on when we started to create the awareness of the female membership in FIFPro. And then, of course, the World 11, which didn't exist on the women's side, which was also something that female players really was eager to have. So the combination of that and the resources that we now have in FIFPro is actually sitting on the table with 4 more players and active players to discuss the contribution of women's football to football. And I think the conditions that we talked about before, I think that's the most important part for FIFA to deal with, to bring women's football and football, also men's football, to another dimension. Because if we don't get the conditions right and then transparency in football, eventually I think football will lose its position in society when it comes to like the fair game. I think we have a window of opportunity of couple of years now where football has to transfer into much more transparent organization. And with that comes sustainability, quality, diversity, and good conditions for everybody, not just for players, but all workers that have anything to do with football. So I think that's what football needs to do to keep on being seen as the world's best sport.
Well, we are very lucky to have someone like you fighting alongside us in this fight. I'm very grateful for the work you're doing. It is so, so important and something that I hope we continue to see improvements in all of the areas you're mentioning, which brings me to my final question. What do you think the legacy of the 2023 Women's World Cup, held, of course, in Australia and New Zealand, will be?
Well, I think there's parts of a legacy that's already been established. And I think that has had to do with the actual bidding process. I think in that process, Australia and New Zealand actually put in some extra things, which I think should have been in the criteria from the beginning, but they actually over-delivered. And I think that's something that will never go back. So I think they've already done something, for sure. Then I think, again, it's going to be more teams. It's going to be in two countries. And honestly, I think it's going to be the best World Cup on the women's side so far. And I think, again, I hope that the conditions of the World Cup means better conditions also for women players around the world after the World Cup. So everything from prize money to conditions set in the actual framework of the cup, like the regulations of the tournament when you're there, is so good that you can't go back from that either. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably the legacy, if we don't talk about the excitement of just being there and traveling there and see the games and so on. I think that's going to be. And then I think when it comes to financial parts, I think it's going to be the World Cup where it starts to see how much commercial value a Women's World Cup have, for sure. And I think it's going to be the first time that FIFA actually is working for that.
Yeah.
I think they felt it in the World Cup in France. Are they going to work for it?
I hope so. Well,
but Ali, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
What do you think is going to happen with the World Cup in your country?
Well, I really, really hope that having the World Cup, having the best players in the world, again, having even more teams, even more players, even more chance for a new star to break through, it will inspire more players to pick up a ball. And I think in New Zealand, we really need that. And not just specifically maybe to play soccer. I think that's more a metaphor of that little girls will feel confident, will see strong women of all different, you know, beliefs, shapes, sizes, colors, and will just be inspired to follow their dreams, whatever that may be. And of course, I hope it is sport, because I really do believe that sport really helps young girls for so many different reasons. But I just think that women are so important in society. I think we are so strong. We have been, you know, oppressed and had to fight the fight in all different areas of society for so long, and still excel and succeed at so many things. And sport is a big example of that. So I hope that the more little girls who feel inspired and motivated, the better. And I definitely think being from a small country where, of course, we're seeing excitement around rugby. And for me, of course, I hope there's more investment in soccer because I love the sport and I want us to have a successful national team. I want us to continue to improve and develop the game. But for me, just if there are a few sports that little girls can choose from and make a living off of, if that is what they dream to do, then I think we would be doing something special, which is why I think having the slogan Beyond Greatness, that's really for me what that means. That, of course, we'll see greatness on the pitch, but we're going to go beyond that and we're going to create something that will have this ripple effect in society.
Yeah. And I think, to be honest, Ali, you're doing that already. I would call you a world citizen. You're traveling around, you have been around. And I think you actually, by doing things like this, but also just by sharing what you do on social media, you already are an inspiration. And in that case, also changing already now, small girls and boys view of the future and what's available out there, but also what's doable.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I am so happy that you could be on the podcast from the other side of the world. And I continue to keep working with you in FIFA Pro and beyond.
Yeah.
So thank you.
And thank you, all of you out there that are pushing for football and women's football and sport in society.
That's all for this episode of the FIFA Pro podcast, Changing the Game. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do like, subscribe, and review it, or maybe share it with a friend. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.